Dave.
Earlier this week, the headmaster of a prestigious prep school in Buckinghamshire was sentenced to 8 years in prison for abusing his pupils. Roland Wright, who's now 83, taught at the Caldecott Boys Prep School, where Nick Clegg was later a pupil. He abused boys. He is between 8 and 13, between 1959 and 1970. Two other former teachers at the school admitted offences last year. One of the first people to make a complaint against Roland Wright was Tom Perry. He came forward in 2001, decades after he was abused. And Tom is with us now.
Good evening, Stephen.
Good evening, Tom. First of all, thank you so much for talking to us tonight.
Pleasure.
Can you tell us what happened?
Well, yes, to set the scene, I started attending the school when I was 8 years old. And very quickly, I was became rapidly addicted to sport. Sport was a terribly important feature of the school. And I sort of pretty much excelled at rugby. I took to rugby like there was no business at all. And I noticed that the rugby players were really the stars in this school. You know, they wore blue tassels in their socks. They were treated as an elite. They had these wonderful rugby caps made of velvet and gold braid, very much modelled on the English rugby cap. Wonderful, wonderful strip. And I thought, well, I don't know, that's where I'm aiming for. That's where I want to go. And, of course, what I didn't know as a naive 8-year-old, or for that matter, a naive 12-year-old, was that the rugby boys were of very significant interest to Mr. Wright because they were athletic, many of them very good-looking. Mr. Wright, as we now know, had a certain type. And I fitted all those criteria. And his favourites usually became the captain of rugby. And I have to say they were the best players who became captain of rugby. And I achieved that objective. I became captain.
And I believe that Roland Wright was charismatic.
Oh, yes, he was urbane, charismatic. The mothers loved him. He was charming. He was, a sort of sophisticated flirt. And the mothers absolutely adored this. And here was the next bit. If he showed an interest in their boys, of course, they became even more addicted to the charms of Mr. Wright. But therein lay the danger. And my mother was one of those. My mother became a cheerleader for Mr. Wright, very close to him, welded to him almost. My mother was flattered by the attentions he lavished upon her. But really, those attentions were lavished upon her for all sorts of really rather ulterior motives.
I'm trying to understand that dynamic. What do you mean upon her? Because a teacher and a parent usually doesn't have much contact.
Well, no, that was quite the opposite. Because you see, the mothers and the parents of the boys involved in the rugby team had a huge amount of contact. There were two matches every week, one normally home, one normally away. There was a great social whirl around the rugby elite. There were rugby dinners. There were all sorts of things. I mean, huge social occasions. It was a social whirl if you achieved that elite status. And so, therefore, there was enormous contact with the mothers and the parents as a whole.
Did he groom you?
Unquestionably, he did. I mean, here was a man.
Why?
Well, here was a man who was, when he started abusing me, he was 34 years old. I was a 12-and-a-half-year-old boy, a little bit older than that. And he lived in a bed sitting room in the senior dormitory's wing. Okay, so he was right in the centre of the senior dormitories, and he was meant to be caring for us there. But this man also drove an E-type Jaguar, was very well-dressed, and had a flat in Ebury Street, just off Sloane Square, in London. What was he doing living in a bedsit, you know, in a boarding school? Now, that bedsit became, you know, almost home station for the rugby elite, because they were allowed to go in and out of there at will. There was a television in there. Don't forget, it was a fairly austere boarding school. I think there were two televisions in the whole of the building, the whole of the campus. And he had one of them. He was quite a wealthy chap. and there were sofas in there. There was a little bit of home. You were welcome to go in there. We danced around him. You know, when you're in the sporting elite, you are going to be touched, moved. The normal physical defences are broken down as you're taught about various moves, passing the rugby ball effectively, you know, sort of all off the wrong foot. It was a very professionally run operation. And so this tactile arrangement, you know, frankly became second nature, and then it was a ruffle of the hair, a hand on the shoulder, a stroke of the back of the neck, and it all became perfectly normalised. And that's how the barriers, the physical barriers that we all naturally have, started to disappear.
I'm very aware, by the way, tonight that, you know, we could, because we're talking about a story of abuse here,
yeah.
Tom.
Yeah.
And I'm very aware that for some people listening, they might not want to hear some of the detail that
they're
may
not
come
going
up.
To, and I wouldn't dream of telling them. That just doesn't happen.
I do just want to say to people, though, that if they don't even want to hear about, you know, the nature of abuse, that we will be doing this for the next 10 minutes or so. But of course, I completely understand what you're saying, Tom.
I know I'm going to be very careful, I can assure you, because that's not something that, I mean, I was with about 25 abusees after court, and the police were wandering around during that time, and they said no evidence was discussed in the room. Other things were, the dynamics and the things that surround abuse were discussed, but the mechanics of abuse was most certainly not. That doesn't happen.
Can I ask you how this abuser, this man, how was he able to feel confident to move from the stage of exploiting what a boy, how to pass a ball? How was he able to manipulate that into abusing you?
Attention. You know, this was the charisma, Mr. Charisma. We craved his attention. Every match we played in, we got a match report. We had a dossier, and it was full of match reports on every boy for every match. Now, those dossiers, those reports were we waited for them with bated breath because we wanted that praise lavished upon us. There was that. Then the captain of rugby, or the captain of, well, rugby, and usually was quite often the captain of cricket, would go to away matches in his E-type Jaguar, drophead E-type Jaguar. I mean, these were little boys' dreams. This was fabulous. Rugby dinners we went out on. We were given wine. It was just intoxicating. We were built up. We were dressed like dolls as well.
And this teacher with the charisma and the manipulative characteristics that is so often indicative of an abuser.
Yeah.
After he had abused you.
Yes.
Would he speak to you? How did he keep on the front of caring about you after he abused you?
Well, there's a very interesting thing. This is going to make some people feel very uncomfortable. But look, I just want to tell you my opinion, and it's shared with many others or by many others. This is going to sound very strange, so roll with it. It's just language that is different and that you haven't heard. I was serially abused, repeatedly. Night in, I won't say night out, but it was sometimes twice a week, sometimes three times a week.
From age 13?
From age 12, 11, yes, that's right, 12 years, 11 months through to about 13, 6 months. Okay, whilst I was there boarding. And what happens is that I was effectively in a ultra-secret relationship. That's what I was in. That's what I felt I was in. I was a 12-year-old boy, 8 months, who knew nothing about sex at all. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And I became a boy at the age of 12 years, 9 months, who knew far too much about sex. And I was called through to his, I was, you know, collected from my dormitory, taken through to the bedroom, and sex was performed on a regular basis. And that's just how it happened. And people knew I was the special boy.
And did you therefore think that was the norm?
Well, it was normalised for me, and I'll tell you why. I'll tell you how as well. Before I was captain, you know, I was aspiring to be captain, and the captain of rugby sat on Mr. Wright's table and at meals. And at breakfast, every breakfast was a compulsory attendance for all staff. And, of course, it was compulsory for boys. However, Mr. Wright, for some reason, seemed to be able to flout attending breakfast with impunity. And I regularly saw the captain, who was my hero and was, you know, with us after sentencing. I saw him regularly take a cup of tea up to Mr. Wright's room and never return. And my then 11-year-old mind said, well, if I become captain, I'm going to have to do that. Well... And I thought nothing more of it because my mind couldn't get there because I knew nothing of what might have been happening.
Did you face him in court?
I did face him in court. He was the I faced him in court twice because the first jury, quite staggeringly, it was a hung jury, and quite how that happened, nobody has any idea. In the second trial, it was a unanimous verdict on all charges. I was there as a witness, and... he was the closest person to me, apart from the prosecuting QC, because he was not sitting in the dock. Did that bother me? Not at all.
Did he make eye contact?
No, he never made eye contact with me. No.
How do you spot someone like that?
No, you don't. They don't wear badges. They're non-identifiable. And that's part of the problem. However, there are some telltale signs in the grooming process. And that's not something that's greatly understood. And that is something which, you know, I'm agitating about insofar as things like mandatory reporting are concerned, which I'm...
You're campaigning for that.
I am campaigning for that like you wouldn't believe.
This is when people who don't report child abuse could face criminal charges.
Well, yes, but actually that's looking at the wrong end of the telescope, because very simply, if you want to change culture within a regulated activity, which is a school, hospital, sports organisation, faith setting, you have to have the spine of law, which says you must report, because what you're then doing is you're removing many decisions that staff are having to make at the moment or being expected to make when they're ill-equipped to do so. We want a report to be made so that it goes to the local authority, which is meant to happen at the moment. All this is meant to happen. It's hardly new and rocket science, this.
Yeah, but it's guidance at the moment.
It's guidance. You've got it in one. And guidance. Look... And guidance says you should do this. Well, look, I should lose weight. I should take more exercise. I should perhaps drink less. But, you know, I don't. And that, I'm afraid, is the same with child protection. You should do it. Well, great. What does that mean?
Do you think Wright showed any remorse at the trial?
None. He didn't flinch when the verdict was handed down to him, and he didn't flinch yesterday when he was told he was getting 8 years in prison.
He's 83.
He's 83.
So he'd be lucky to come out alive. Do you care?
Personally, I have to say, it doesn't bother me. He's serving an 8-year sentence. I'm serving a life sentence.
What is the long-lasting impact of abuse on you?
Profound. 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 I think I'll leave it there, but it is profound. Let me just tell you about a friend who's one of our number. He ended up a 6'3" heroin addict on the streets of Edinburgh. He was with me after sentencing. He's got his life back together again. I mean, he really has. He had his stomach pumped for the first time when he was 14. He was an alcoholic and a heroin addict. and he's managed to remain upright, and he's now got convictions. He was abused by three men at the school. I mean, this was just a child abuse factory. And it would have been helped when I was taking tea up, or when the predecessor captain who I saw was taking tea up, that the staff in that school had reported. They must have known, because they could see it. I saw it and knew that this is what I'd have to do. And the captain never returning. And then we discovered, actually, and here's the extraordinary thing, Stephen. We then discovered, because I've been at this for quite some time, we then discovered that Mr. Wright, in 1963, had acquired an interest in the school. He was therefore untouchable. Because if you reported on Mr. Wright, you wouldn't last very long. You'd be out of a job. Because currently, then, as now, if you're going to report child abuse, by default, you're a whistleblower. And whistleblowers don't have a good lifespan.
Yeah, I know it takes a lot to speak about something that is so personal, Tom. And I really appreciate it. And I'm glad that man is where he belongs.
And all I can say is I hope your listeners will go and look at Mandate Now, which is our petition website to get mandatory reporting introduced.
Thank you, Tom.
My pleasure, Stephen.